Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and a happy new year to you. We are now celebrating 2024, and what a year it's going to be. We really appreciate you tuning in and, of course, watching us on WVW TV, which is a great network. We've been on air since 2006. And we bring you some very, very important viewpoints and opinions and ideas that really contribute to the great marketplace of ideas. We appreciate you watching us, and it's been an interesting year. I have been on the air since the last week of February of 2023, and there's been a lot of information that's happened within the last year, of course, and here we are in 2024, starting a brand new year, and of course, a year that is destined to be let's just say very interesting because of the political the big event, of course, is the election, the presidential election, and that's going to be quite a wild ride. So this is not a political show, but there is no way to separate politics from finance, and I think in an election year we're going to be talking a lot about politics as it relates to finances, because ultimately you're going to have to, as an individual, deal with the blowback and the blowout and the whatever of the election system. And it's, you know, we're in a precarious place. To give an example of that, when I started this show, it was the last week of February 2023, and I'm still chuckling. The very first episode, that we had a technical failure, so I ended up grabbing my cell phone and finishing the show, talking into my cell phone up against a white wall. I mean, talk about quick thinking on your feet. But we've come to the point now where I've gone from my shishi downtown industrial space, and we'll talk about that a little bit today, to a more studio environment, because, as you know, WVW TV always works to improve its image, its message, its viewability. And we are making changes. And of course, you can see my great background, and working in a studio environment gives me more control over production, of course. And we're going to be working on our sound quality next. And of course, maybe, I don't know, maybe I need a makeover. Who knows? We'll see. But anyway, when I started the show back in February, I was talking about a phenomenon that is of great interest to me. In my academic career, I spent a lot of time analyzing the macro economy. And there are different thought silos or thought traditions or thought schools of thought with respect to the macro economy, because in the world of economics, the dismal science, as it's called, the whole idea is to be able to analyze a macro economy, a national economy, a regional economy, perhaps an international economy, and prognosticate. You know, you get your crystal ball out and you become the soothsayer of economics. And what you're trying to do is predict the future. Basically, that's what it's all about. Nobody cares about the past. Everybody's trying to look at past data, current data, and analyze that and come up with some idea of what's going to happen tomorrow. Well, you know, that's a tricky thing, because maybe with the advent of AI or supercomputers or something, somebody will have a little bit better chance of predicting the future, but it's not easy, and it's very much an academic exercise. This is not something, and that's why, you know, because if you look at the stock market, the bond market, any markets, I mean, if somebody could predict the future, you'd make a lot of money, because you'd all be right. Well, the reality is, no matter how you apply your best formulas, your best data, your best guesses, you basically tend to become, you know, a fortune teller, and that's sort of the world of economics and the world of finance. But I wanted to mention that in February of 2023, I started by complaining about the national debt, and it was $32 trillion, and it had risen rather sharply. And I pointed out that this is not good for national security. And of course, there's some real issues as to how much debt is too much for 330 million Americans. And $32 trillion was a lot of money. Well, of course, while we're all sipping eggnog and enjoying the holidays, the last 2 weeks we've been, not broadcasting, and economics happens. You know, it's certainly something that continues to happen. And the big story, of course, is that while we were sipping eggnog and exchanging gifts and wishing each other the merriest of Christmas and other holidays, the national debt managed to top $34 trillion. Now, that's $2 trillion more than it was in February when I started broadcasting. And here I am today, the first broadcast day of 2024, and we're up $2 trillion. Now, that's, you know, for people who are in these different silos, there are different thoughts, economic schools. You have the classical Adam Smith supply and demand. And then, of course, you have the Keynesian model, which is borrow and spend until you're broke. And then, of course, you have the Marxist model, which everybody owns everything and nobody owns anything, but everybody's happy until the Soviet Union collapses. And 70 years later, you start over. They're all different philosophies of economics. Of course, my philosophy, the one I'm interested in, and I spent some academic time not only reading the literature, reading the prevailing thought, doing some research. Effectively, it's called the Austrian School of Economics. And it's not because we run around in lederhosen and yodel like my ancestors from Austria did, which is kind of cool. Maybe we should, but we don't do that. We basically look at a model that is based upon hard money rather than fiat money. Of course, the difference is hard money is backed by gold and silver or something. And fiat money is printed, you know, it used to be printed on a printing press. Now it's just manufactured inside of your computers or somebody's computers, not yours. You should not be managing or manufacturing money. Leave that to the Federal Reserve. But the point is, in a hard money perspective, when we take a look at different economic philosophies or theologies, perhaps philosophies, the hard money crowd like me and the Austrian crowd is looking at this $34 trillion in debt with amazement, shock, bewilderment, and perhaps a bit of awe, because we know, after looking at data from around the world for many, many years and centuries, that when governments start to print too much money, going back to the Roman Empire, when you start to dilute the value of your hard currency and you start printing up money based upon nothing but, you know, hope, bad things happen. And of course, $2 trillion in less than 1 year, we're about, what, six weeks away from my first anniversary. What it tells you, what it tells us, is that the inability of the federal government to manage its tax and spend and its annual budget is become a problem. We're in a vortex, basically. And when you think about $2 trillion added to the national debt in less than a year, that's a big deal. That's a really big deal. And ultimately, there's going to be blowback. It just happens. Now, I've used the example a number of times in the last year, and I want to share my cute little story that I would dazzle my students with as to what is a trillion. And, you know, you think about it, well, 32, that's not a big number. What's 32? That's a small number, right? What's 33? What's 34? That's a small number. We don't, you know, who cares? 32, 34, those are small numbers, right? But when you add the trillion part after the 33, the 32, 34, it becomes a very large number. And I'm going to perhaps bore some of you and amaze others of you watching with exactly what is a trillion. So let me say again, if I were to stand here or perhaps sit here and hand you a dollar bill every second, how long would it take me to hand you $1 trillion? I'm going to hand you a dollar bill every second. How long? How long would that take? You know, you get your calculator out, do the math. And if you do that, you'll find out that it's 56,800 and some years. Okay. 56,000, almost 59,000 years. Well, folks, I ain't going to make it at my age, and neither are you. But the point is, it's a very, very big number. And that's just to do it once, 56,800 years to do it once. I'd have to do it 33 more times. So the point is, if you think about a trillion of anything or 34 trillion of anything, it becomes a vast number that is incomprehensible by people. If you think about what else is there a trillion of? Well, there could be a trillion stars in the sky, but who knows? You know, nobody's ever counted them. And there could be a trillion grains of sand on your favorite beach. Maybe there is. Who knows? Nobody's ever counted them. But we know for a fact that $34 trillion is owned. Every last dollar is owned by someone. And I'm going to talk about that. An interesting story today that caught my eye about this idea of federal debt and federal bonds. So we are in a place where the federal debt of the United States, and this only happens, I mean, nobody, we don't have a king and we're not part of an empire and there's no emperor far across the seas. This is right here on the Potomac, right here in the United States of America, although it's not happening in any one state because the District of Columbia is not in a state. They want to be a state because they want two more senators. But the reality is it's this little island that controls 50 states. You know, they're kind of stuck on the eastern end of our continent. And from that place emanates a Congress and a presidency and, of course, a court system, you know, three branches of government. And at the end of the day, that group of folks has spent $34 trillion that they didn't have. And that's why it is national debt. OK, they borrowed it. Now, of course, there are people in different silos of economic thought. Like the Keynesians will say, what's the difference? We borrow it from our left pants pocket and we put it in our right pants pocket. We're borrowing it from ourselves. Who cares? It doesn't matter. Well, that's where I beg to differ. And I think from a financial perspective, as well as an economic perspective, every last one of those dollars is on somebody else's balance sheet. So if I go to the website, there's a website you can go to and buy federal debt. You can buy savings bonds, or you can buy one-year bond or notes or T-bills or notes or bonds. I mean, you can do this yourself. You can go and buy federal debt all by yourself by merely creating an account and, you know, connecting it to your bank, and they'll take your dollars and they will assign a bond to you. Well, from your perspective as a person, a human, that bond is important because let's say you've got, you know, rich old Uncle Miller died and left you 10 grand and you think I'm going to be prudent in 2024 and the interest rates are kind of up there. So I'll buy a 1-year federal note. OK, and you go to the website, log in, 10,000 goes to the Treasury and they give you a bond. Well, let me tell you, folks, you will look at that $10,000 bond as an asset. And if that thing is worthless or it wasn't worth $10,000, you'd be very upset. Of course, that won't happen because it's federal debt. You can rest assured that at least for this snapshot in time, if you give them $10,000 and they give you a bond, you will have a $10,000 bond. And a year later, it's a note. And actually, 1 year could be a bill. But the point is, at the end of the year, you're going to get your $10,000 back plus whatever interest Uncle Sam promised, and you'll get it. And that's the way it will work. But my point is that those bonds are an asset on your balance sheet. And it's the same thing with anybody who buys a federal bond. Number one, it's the largest debt market in the world. It's vast because there's $34 trillion in there. And people will buy that as security. And the reason they do that is because they believe in the full faith and credit of the United States government, which hasn't defaulted since our creation, although three times some people argue that there was a default, but the reality is it's as safe a place to park your money as there is in this world today. And that's why that debt is monetized, and it's an asset to somebody. And what I'm leading into is the story that I saw, and it was an analysis on a financial website that I follow from time to time. And the argument was, has the federal Congress looted the Social Security Fund? And let's think about the Social Security Fund as to how it's structured. Back in its creation in the 1930s, the idea was we'd set up a pension fund for all Americans, because some lucky workers worked for big companies who had pensions. And that was nice because back in those days, you'd get a job and you'd work for 30 years, then you'd retire, you'd have your pension, and then you'd quickly die. And then, you know, the pension would pay you or maybe your survivors. And it was a nice program for people to have. But there were the haves and there were the have-nots. And the vast majority of Americans were not participating in a pension fund. And of course, when they retired or became ill and had to stop working, it became a financial burden to the states and the counties. So the idea in Congress was, we're going to set up a national retirement income plan, and it's going to be based on a pension fund mechanism. And of course, there was a lot of back and forth in Congress, and there were the Wall Street types that said, this is great. Boy, we're going to take all this money in from every taxpayer in America. We're going to invest it in Wall Street. And, we're going to grow a big pile of money, and we'll have a great big pension fund, like all the other pension funds were managed. And then there were people, the more Democratic, small D Democratic, said, probably not a good idea to give the national retirement funds to the Wall Street guys. Let's set up a government office to run the thing. And of course, that's what prevailed. Except the Social Security office. And lo and behold, a tax was instituted. And in the United States, the way this works is that the worker pays half and the employer pays the other half, because the tax, I'm going to use a round number of 15%. So if you're self-employed, you have to pay 15% of your earnings to the Social Security program in addition to your federal income tax. That's the way it's set up. If you work for somebody else, you're an employee, W-2 employee, you pay the 7.5, and you can see it says FICA, federal, FICA tax, and you pay 7.5% in, and your employer gets to pay the other 7.5. So when you are hired for $10 an hour, and there's a 15% tax for Social Security, your employer isn't paying you $10 an hour. They're paying you $10 an hour plus Social Security, and now Medicare, of course, the same thing. And there's an employment tax, which in my view has always been crazy. Why would you tax people who hire other people? You think you give them an incentive? No, let's tax them. You hire a new employee and the federal government will tax you for hiring the new employee. That's not an incentive to hire new employees, but it's been going on forever. So that's the way it is. So the point is, the money goes into the Social Security thing. And originally the idea was there'd be a great big pool of money and they'd invest it. And then as people started to retire, then they would be drawing their Social Security payments, and then new people would be pumping money in on the back end, and the old people would be taking it out on the front end. And of course they die off and then the benefit stops and there's no legacy benefit. Now, there's a true up for a marital situation where when a spouse dies, the other spouse can opt to the higher payment, whether it's their own or the deceased spouse. But the point is, when the harp plays and the trumpet blasts and you're called to your eternal glory, the Social Security stops. You can't leave it to your kids, grandkids. It's that you get a payment. And that's a problem, very sadly, when some people work a very long time and they get into their 60s, and just before they apply for Social Security that they've paid in for all these years, decades, they pass away, and lo and behold, it's gone. And that's a problem, because you've put money in and it's grown, your employer's put in money, but the reality is that's a benefit plan for the people. It's not for you. It's not individualized. And I think back in the George W. Bush days, there was talk about privatizing Social Security, and of course the media barbecued George W. Bush because he was going to loot your Social Security and give it to the Wall Street greedy guys, and then grandma'd be broke. And of course, the problem is that if you look at the Social Security system, how it works, it's very convoluted. And that's why Americans don't understand it. And that's why people like Al Gore and other politicians can make stupid statements like the lockbox, and they robbed the lockbox. It's air. It's hot air political stuff. And that's why you tune into shows like mine, so you can maybe learn a little bit about how these things actually work, so that when the next politician comes along and says, the other guy's raiding the lockbox, you'll say, there is no lockbox. There's no lockbox. What are you talking about? But, if you don't know this stuff, well, then there's a lockbox, and it was raided by the Republican, of course, never the Democrat raided the lockbox. But at the end of the day, you really want to know what's going. So this is what happens. The money goes in every 2 weeks, every time there's a payroll, whether it's weekly, biweekly, monthly, whatever. You put in your 5.5 or your 7.5%, your employer puts in the 7.5%, or if you're self-employed, you're doing this quarterly, you're putting the money in. And what the Social Security system does is it invests that money in federal debt, the bonds, the bills, the notes, the federal treasuries. And right now there's $2.7 trillion that the Social Security plan holds. And of course, they take the money in, and you've got to invest it somewhere. I suppose you could take it to the bank and maybe take it on a CD. But when you're talking $2.7 trillion, where do you go with that kind of money and not move a market? The only market you can invest in is this gigantic $34 trillion federal debt market. And, you know, 2.7 isn't going to move the market. And it doesn't all go in at once and all come out at once. It goes in, it goes out. I mean, it's like a flow, you know. And when you look at the return that the Social Security system has generated over the course of its life, well, to give you an example, according to the story, a very, very well-written story, is that the average in 2022, this is, you know, now it's like 2 years ago, but it's actually, you know, about 13, 14 months ago, is 2.35%. So they take all this Social Security money, and, you know, they're very careful. They buy all these bonds and they ladder them, they structure them. There's all sorts of strategies you use in the bond world to ladder your maturities and your yield so that you can maximize the return on your portfolio. So what every bond fund does, it's what every pension fund does. So the Social Security Department does as well. So they've got, you know, they've got $2.7 trillion in federal debt. And they're making 2.35% return. Well, that's not so good. I mean, if you look at the Standard & Poor's, which is the stock market, Standard & Poor's is, you know, it's an index of stocks that go up and they go down. So since the early 1960s, they've averaged 10.5%. So, and that gives credence to people who say, man, instead of investing the Social Security proceeds, the income, into federal bonds at 2.35%, let's gamble it in the stock market and make 10.5% instead. And if that had happened, of course, the Social Security system would be bulging with money. They'd be begging people to retire, take some of this money. We don't know what to do with it all. But that's not the case. So there's a large delta between the return on the bonds over time and the stock market. Now, and it's an interesting argument, and I think that's what George W. Bush, President Bush II, was making, that there are better alternatives to investing Social Security money than basically taking that money and dumping it into government bonds at 2.35%. And there's some truth to that. But there's also some problems in that whenever you take $2.7 trillion and put it all into one place, you move the market. You begin to distort the market. And that is probably the largest pool of managed money. Now, there's probably some other place, places here and there. But at the end of the day, that is a huge amount of money to move. So then the question is, well, maybe you invest half in the stock market and you invest the other half in T-bills and bonds, you know, federal debt. But the problem with that, of course, is that there's risk. And when you look at the federal debt market, we think of it as risk-free, but that raises the bigger question. Is it still as risk-free at $34 trillion and counting based upon a population of 330 million people? That's a lot of people. And the United States is a big country. But when you look at India at 1.5 billion, and you look at China at 1.5 billion, and you add that up, and it's like, you know, 3 billion people, you know, we're at 1/10 of China and India, and then there's the rest of the world. You know, forget about them. At the end of the day, the debt starts to be bigger than the population base can reasonably handle, and that becomes a big part of the problem. This isn't tax and spend like Adam Smith would have, you know, encouraged. You know, we want to fund the public good. And, you know, if you've studied public good economics, you realize that public goods, there's no private free market that will build a road because there's no revenue. You know, there's a lot of expense, a lot of capital outlay, but there's no revenue. So how do you make money with a road? So nobody builds a road or a bridge or a police department. You know, none of these things are revenue generating, but they're public good. So the whole idea of public good is to tax the populace. The population, and take the money and then spend it on the public good. And, you know, at the local level, that works. Municipal budgets and county budgets, the state budgets are balanced, except for, you know, the perennial losers like California and Illinois. But the idea is that you're going to tax your people and spend the money and make life better for everyone. And that's that public goods idea. So if you think about this idea of federal debt that's detached from this tax to spend for the public good, and of course this is the Keynesian model, the Keynesian multiplier, tax to spend, borrow and spend, borrow yourself into oblivion, it's really starting to raise big questions from a strategic perspective, from the Social Security you know, the safety of that fund, if they're invested 100% in federal debt and the federal debt markets start to get a little squirrely, then you're putting the Social Security system at risk, based on the inherent nature of the structure of our government, which is vast budget deficits that accumulate into federal debt. It's weakening the system. So then the question becomes, in order to preserve Social Security for future Americans, you know, what do you do? Should you be thinking about diversification? You've got Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch all saying, federal government, you know, they're not the AAA they used to be. Then suddenly, as a prudent person theory, you know, that when you manage other people's money, there's a concept of the prudent person, the prudent trustee theory, where you're required by law to act prudently. You have to start thinking about that. And that puts a lot of pressure on the people running the Social Security portfolio. And, you know, the lockbox, there wasn't a lockbox, but what there is $2.7 trillion pot of money that is used to fund Social Security. So the question is, should they diversify? Should they be looking at other things? And of course they can't. And you look, you know, the federal statutes say you must invest in federal bonds. And back in a day when we had a more balanced budget, or at least a closer to being balanced budget with a much smaller federal deficit, that was an idea that made sense. I mean, effectively, the federal, you know, you're taking money out of the system from employees and employers, you're putting it on the Social Security pot account, and then they turn around and buy federal debt, and that allows the federal government to spend beyond its means, and that, you know, theoretically grows the economy, and then there's more people paying in, and it's one of, like, you know, these perpetual motion machines. But the reality is, there are limits, and when you look at $34 trillion in debt, and nothing is slowing this down. By the time, you know, if you're still listening to me, and I hope you are, by next June and July, I will very much be jabbering about $35 trillion in debt, and it's going up, and there's really nothing that is going to slow that down. So you think, wow, well, this is a real mess. We have a Congress that simply cannot pass a balanced budget. We have an administration that has no interest in passing a balanced budget or signing a budget into law that will restrict the government. I mean, it's just print and spend and print. There is no nexus between how much money they tax the people and how much money the federal government spends. So, you know, I saw another story over the holiday talking about the collections from the Internal Revenue Service are very high right now. They're going out and they're looking for every dollar, and you know, you got to pay your taxes, and you know, you're expected to do that. But at the end of the day, they're still very far short of federal spending. Even if you collect every last tax dollar that's owed by every last person, you're way short. So the only discipline that can happen at the federal level is that Congress will say, we will not spend more than the people of America can afford in taxes. And we're way beyond that. You simply cannot take a $2 trillion deficit and cut back. What do you cut? Every last dollar spent in Washington has a lobby force behind it. There's lobbyists who say, if you cut this, people will die, you know, the streets will be littered. At the end of the day, once you start spending, it's impossible to turn off. So what do you do? I mean, what ultimately happens? And I think that's going to be the topic of, I guess, this semester's lectures, is how do you prepare yourselves for the inevitable when there's an adjustment, and an adjustment will come. And, you know, when you look at, you know, this immigration thing, you know, all these people are piling in across the southern border, and the administration just simply does not care. They want bodies in America. And you ask yourself the question, you know, say, what, well, other than, you know, theoretically, they're all going to vote Democrat, right? Well, I'm not so sure. I think people from other cultures who take the time and effort to figure out a way to sneak into the United States, they want to be here, and they're not signing up to become what they left. They're signing up for the dream, the American dream, which, you know, I hope they find it. But at the end of the day, you know, if you add 10 million new people, and they're all paying taxes into the Social Security system, and they're all paying taxes to the federal government, that's one way to make up for your inability to manage your budget. The other way, and of course, in order to bring this back to even, you have to, like, double the population of America. I mean, that would be fundamentally changing the United States. You know, but the second way, of course, is inflation. And when you look at what gold did over 2023, was very interesting. Gold started out, let's say, $1,800 and finished at an all-time record high, and then slid back a little bit. But at the end of the day, it went from 1800 to 2100, basically. And what it tells you, and of course, gold is a very interesting metric. It's the kind of thing that is, it's sort of like, guns and gold are the same thing. You really ought to have one, but you pray you never have to use one, okay? And it's sort of the same with gold. You really ought to have some precious metals, and you really hope the heck that you wasted your money, because if those precious metals are suddenly worth 50 grand an ounce, that's the that is not, it may be a windfall for you, but when you open your front door and you look out on the street, you're not going to recognize the community you live in. It's not good. It would be much better, much more prudent to just tax and spend and live within your means, keeping in mind we're a country of 330 million, not 1.5 billion. Well, that's it for today, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's great to be back with you. Looking forward to an exciting 2024. And thanks so much for watching WVW TV. We really appreciate your viewership. So have a great afternoon and talk to you tomorrow. Bye.